Good day. Today is Tuesday, 3rd March 2026. And before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this programme or whichever part of this programme you want to watch or listen to, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate that fact. Well, today we are in the fourth day of the war between the United States and Israel and Iran. And I will begin by saying that the most important thing in this war up to now is what has not happened. We have not seen demonstrations and protests in Iran against the government there. We have not seen signs that Iranian society is fracturing in the way that I suspect many people anticipated. And above all, we've seen no evidence of the dissident, of the dissent amongst sections of the Iranian military, no signs of defections, no signs of military units assembling and moving towards the capital to take control. We've seen no evidence of this taking place, despite information that we had from the US journalist Seymour Hersh that there were contacts between the US and Israeli intelligence agencies and top Iranian military officials, and despite the fact that John Bolton, Donald Trump's arch neocon national security advisor, also said that in order for this operation to succeed against Iran, defections from the military are needed. And, well, to repeat again what I've said many times, this is a war of attrition now, a war of endurance. If Iran is able to keep fighting, if it is able to keep resisting, if it is able to preserve intact its political and governmental system, then eventually Iran wins. Iran wins not on the battlefield. It is not in a position to defeat the armies and air forces and navies of Israel and the United States. Iran wins by surviving. In fact, its approach to war is very similar to the one that Henry Kissinger, Richard Nixon's Secretary of State and National Security Advisor, once attributed to the North Vietnamese. If the North Vietnamese do not lose, they win. If we do not win over the North Vietnamese, we lose. And that is exactly what is playing out at the present time in the Middle East. On the contrary, what we have seen is Iran continue to take the war to its enemies. It continues to conduct air and missile strikes against US bases across the Middle East. It also launched a drone attack on the US embassy in Riyadh, something which has dismayed the Saudi authorities. It has also continued to attack the facilities of the US Navy in Bahrain, where the United States has its most important naval base in the Persian Gulf. There are reports of increasing protests against the king of Bahrain, in Bahrain itself. Bahrain is an unusual country in the Persian Gulf in that it is an Arab state. It is, of course, an island state. It is an ally of the United States. It has a Sunni royal family. But Sunnis make only 20% of the population. Shia make around 80% of the population. And there have been previous instances when the Shia in Bahrain have made fairly clear that they are dissatisfied and unhappy by the rule of the royal family and have had to seek assistance from the other Gulf states, most specifically from Saudi Arabia. And in fact, I've seen reports that the same thing is happening, that even as the authorities in Bahrain face renewed protests, and perhaps protests are an understatement, I've seen some suggestions that what is happening in Bahrain goes beyond protests and approximates to something closer to an insurrection. Anyway, I've seen footage of Saudi units moving to Bahrain. Bahrain is connected to the mainland, to Saudi Arabia, in other words, by a network of bridges. And I've seen film of Saudi military units moving into Bahrain in order to try to stabilise the situation there and to ensure the preservation of the Sunni monarchy which rules the island. Anyway, so the Iranians continue to conduct these strikes, and they are clearly, despite denials, also attacking oil facilities, and they are also doing what is in some respects their most powerful tool in the war, which is that they are continuing to obstruct traffic through the Straits of Hormuz. They've not mined the Straits of Hormuz, though I am sure that they have the capability to do that. And for all I know, at some point they will. But they've said that ships should not pass through the Straits of Hormuz, which is, by the way, I understand, only 21 kilometres wide. There have been attacks on tankers, and I understand that shipping through the Straits of Hormuz has come to a complete stop. And we are starting to see, we are increasingly seeing, the economic consequences of this. Oil and even more natural gas prices have been rising, not yet to catastrophic levels, but they have been rising. They are continuing to rise today. There are reports that prices of petrol in British petrol stations are now rising rapidly. Apparently, Qatar has had to stop producing natural gas. Qatar, of course, is one of the world's biggest producers of natural gas and is at the centre of the LNG trade, the trade in liquefied natural gas. Of course, ships with liquefied natural gas have to travel from Qatar through the Straits of Hormuz, and they are not for the moment able to do so. Now, I am not an expert in these matters. I'm going to make a guess that liquefied natural gas is probably even more inflammable than, well, much more inflammable, I am sure, than crude oil. Even the very light grades of crude oil we see in the Middle East. If ships carrying liquefied natural gas, which is, of course, in a liquid condition, were to come under attack, well, I don't want to try and guess the consequences. And besides, if I did, I would be going beyond my actual level of knowledge. And the Iranians have been doing other things. Yesterday, I discussed the shooting down, allegedly, or at least reportedly, by friendly fire of three US F-15 fighter jets in Kuwait. It looks as if those fighter jets might have been participating in a more complex operation than has been widely reported. Because Jim Webb, a former US military officer, someone who, at the time when Robert Kennedy Jr. was a presidential candidate in the 2024 election, was his national security advisor, somebody who I have consistently found to be one of the most level-headed and insightful and intelligent commentators on military affairs, someone who we were also privileged on a number of occasions to have as a guest on the Durand. Anyway, he was the first to spot the fact that when the Pentagon reported the loss of these three fighter jets, it also commented on the fact that the Iranian Air Force appeared to be conducting offensive operations. So it looks as if some Iranian fighter jets have been in the air and have been attempting at least to conduct strikes. And in fact, I noticed this morning that one of the Gulf states, I believe it was the UAE, claimed that it had shot down two Iranian Suhoi 24 bombers. Now, some people are jumping to the conclusion that this must mean that Iran has obtained fighter jets recently from Russia. And there are reports that Iranian MiG-29 fighter jets have been in the sky. I think this would be a premature assumption. The Russians have indisputably supplied Iran with 8 Mi-28 helicopter gunships that are in some ways similar to the American Apache helicopter gunships. And there are indisputable reports that the Russians have supplied Yak-30 trainer aircraft to Iran. These are subsonic aircraft. They're not capable of supersonic speeds. The Russian Air Force uses them purely as training aircraft, but they can be used for ground attack missions. But I understand that only 2 of these aircraft have been supplied. The Russians did offer Iran MiG-29 fighter jets, as I remember, some years ago, but Iran rejected them, holding out for the much more advanced Suhoi 35s, which, by the way, the Russians did agree to supply. But it's also worth remembering that Iran received a number of former Iraqi Air Force MiG-29s way back in 1991, when in advance of the first Gulf War between Iraq and the United States, Saddam Hussein, without first gaining Iran's agreement, transferred many of his most advanced fighter jets to Iraq. So it may be that whatever MiG-29s are currently flying in the Iranian Air Force now are these old MiG-29s that previously belonged to Iraq and which Iran received indirectly from Iraq during the 1990-1991 conflict. And I am guessing that this is true of the two Suhoi 24s, which, as I said, one of the Gulf states claims to have successfully shot down. But it is nonetheless remarkable and very indicative that there do seem to be reports, confirmation, that Iran's air force is functioning. It is not very large. It probably does not have many advanced aircraft. Apparently, the pilots are well trained and skilled, but there's a limit to what they can do. But anyway, they are apparently up there in the sky doing whatever it is that they can. So even that perhaps is a sign that Iran is continuing to resist, and they continue to launch strikes on Israel itself, as well as the various other Gulf states and, of course, Cyprus, which Iranian drones also attacked. Incidentally, on this issue of Iran receiving support from China and Russia, there is a photograph circulating of an Iranian Shahed drone, which supposedly was carrying a Russian manufactured terminal that was enabling Iran to receive data by piggybacking on the American Starlink system. That photo, I don't know who produced it, it was supposed to have been collected or made in Cyprus from a drone that struck one of the British bases there. Anyway, that photo is, I believe, a fake, or rather the photo itself is not a fake, but it is simply a photo taken earlier from debris of a Russian drone shot down in Ukraine. Somebody is circulating this photo to prove Russian involvement in Iran's drone operations, which is simply not the case. So anyway, the Iranians continue to conduct these attacks. And by the way, they still have all kinds of targets that they could attack. They could attack the Dimona, Israeli nuclear facility. That would be an unimaginable escalation. But then there are reports that the Israelis have attacked the Arak facility in Iran. And of course, during the June 2025 war, Iran and the United States attacked, and by the way, claimed to have obliterated the Iranian nuclear facilities at Fordow, Isfahan and Natanz, even though these were civilian facilities at the time, conducting work under the supervision of the International Atomic Energy Authority. So if Iran were to reciprocate by conducting attacks against Israeli nuclear facilities, well, they have the excuse, the reason, if you like, to do it. And, well, they could do much more aggressive things, specifically targeting the US's Arab allies. One of the particular things they could do, which might have devastating effects, is that they could attack the desalination plants across the Arabian Peninsula. These are essential to providing fresh water to the cities. There's been no such attacks yet. I hope there never will be. I cannot imagine what the effect of attacks of that kind would be. So this is what the Iranians are doing. Of course, the Israelis and the Americans continue their own attacks. And there is no doubt that they are doing much more damage to Iran than Iran up to now has been able to inflict on those it is attacking, though one should not underestimate the damage that Iran has done. There's attempts to do so by all sorts of people, but I've seen satellite footage provided for us, by the way, by the Chinese. They show significant damage to the American naval base in Bahrain, where a major radar system was destroyed by the Iranians, apparently on the first day. There's also significant footage of other bases, including the gigantic American air base in Qatar, which have also undoubtedly experienced significant damage. And, well, there's been damage to all sorts of facilities, and there's been damage also to Tel Aviv in particular and to other locations in Israel too. But having said that, obviously, for the moment at least, the Americans and the Israelis are conducting more powerful strikes than the Iranians can carry out against Iran. So far, from what I can see, but then it's likely I'm getting a very incomplete picture, the major targets have been located in central Tehran, where I would have thought the Iranians have removed their key personnel from, just to say. But it looks as if several Iranian warships, including two frigates, have been destroyed and sunk, and that extensive damage in that way has been done. But the key thing always to remember is this: Iran, an enormous country of 90 million people with a huge industrial base, a huge and diverse industrial base that extends right across Iran's enormous territory, can absorb a huge amount of battle damage, whereas Israel, a small country, small territorially and in terms of its population, with very concentrated industries located in a small area, cannot absorb the same levels of damage to the same degree. Now, all of this leads me to the various extraordinary flood of statements that we've been having from the United States over the last 24 hours. Because we're starting to get more and more reports in the Wall Street Journal, reports in Bloomberg, including this morning, that air defense systems and precision guided systems that form the US and Israeli arsenals are starting to run down. And this provoked an extraordinary message on Truth Social by President Trump. He said that there was no truth to these reports. He said that the United States is abundantly supplied with high-end and middle-end weapons. I'm not sure what he means by that, by the way. What exactly does that mean? What are the high-end and middle-end weapons that he's talking about? But he says that there's no shortages of these, except perhaps that there are shortages after all, because further down he also complains that sleepy Joe Biden supplied an excessive amount of these very weapons to the man that President Trump now calls P.T. Barnum. P.T. Barnum was, of course, the circus manager in the late 19th and early 20th century in the United States. The President Donald Trump means Zelensky, Ukraine in other words. And that has supposedly caused problems, but never fear, because President Trump built up the US armed forces during his first term and he's busy doing it again. And there's no real reason to concern, no grounds for concern. And all suggestions that the United States is running out of weapons are untrue. Anyway, that is what Donald Trump says. Of course, he says lots of other different things. He says that the entire Iranian leadership has been wiped out, which begs the question then of who exactly is leading Iran as it continues to fight back. He says that all Iranian air and sea and land forces have been effectively eliminated, which again begs the question of how Iran is fighting. He continues to say that he expects this all to be over within 3 to 4 weeks, but in a unfortunate echo of certain things that Joe Biden and Tony Blinken and Jake Sullivan used to say about Ukraine, he said that the United States will continue fighting Iran for as long as it takes. He's been saying this morning that the Iranians want a deal, but it's too late. The Iranians, in fact, as I discussed in my program yesterday, Ali Larijani, the man who seems to be coordinating Iran's military effort, said quite clearly yesterday that Iran is rejecting all proposals for negotiations and for ceasefires. And of course, it makes logical sense for Iran to do so at the present time. Anyway, President Trump is saying all of these things. And of course, I remember that after the June war, he said that Iran's nuclear program had been entirely obliterated, though he in effect now is telling us something completely different. And in summary, I don't myself think that he has much credibility anymore about the various claims that he is making. And well, this morning I read several reports that say that the Gulf states are running short of air defense interceptors. There was a furious denial of this claim by the government of the United Arab Emirates. They say that they are fully stocked up with air defense missiles. I have to say that the statement was so vehement that it reminded me of that British expression of protesting too much. Anyway, there are reports that all of the Gulf states are starting to run short of air defense missile interceptors, that they have been pleading with the United States to supply them with replacements. They've been coming up against the problem that the United States has no air defense missile interceptors to share, that they've been told that the United States cannot for the moment help with this matter, and that the United States is having to keep back whatever air defense missile interceptors it has for itself. It's having to keep them back to protect the most important Middle East country as far as the United States is concerned, which is, of course, Israel, and to provide protection to its own forces. And apparently there is hand-wringing and anguish about all of this from the Gulf states. And there are also reports that because of the crisis in air defense systems, air defense missile systems, the United States is now having to turn and consider transferring its systems from South Korea, the THAAD and Patriot missile systems that were located there, in what, by the way, the Chinese saw as a major provocation, but that these are going to also have to be transferred to the Middle East, and that the United States is cannibalizing whatever stockpiles of systems around the world that it can. It is also putting pressure on its European allies also to come to the rescue. I noticed, for example, that Greece has transferred its Patriot missiles to Cyprus, where there have been attacks on the British bases. Cyprus, as I of course also remember, came under considerable pressure from the United States and the European Union to transfer its air defence systems to Ukraine, just say. But anyway, it held on to them, or at least it held on to some of them, and those that it has, it's now having to transfer to Cyprus, along with four F-16 fighter jets. Anyway, the Europeans, who up to now have been busy buying air defence missile interceptors, Patriot missile interceptors from the United States, basically as they come off the production line to send them to Ukraine, are having now to think about diverting them to the Middle East instead, and are coming under increasing pressure to do this. And I read a report again in the Financial Times, which has become an interesting source of information about the state of the war, incidentally. Anyway, I read a report today in the Financial Times that already there are complaints that years of production of various types of precision-guided weapons have already been expended by Israel and the United States in the first days of this war. We are talking, to repeat again, about an enormous country, Iran, with a complex and challenging geography, very high mountains, large forested areas, places where things can be hidden, and also a country with a big population and many, many cities. There are reports, again in the Financial Times, that I've seen them in other places, about how Iran has developed a mosaic system of defence. In other words, local Iranian regional commanders have been granted very wide levels of autonomy to conduct operations by themselves, or providing Iran with high levels of redundancy and resiliency, and merely in meaning that an attack on one part of the Iranian defence system does not immediately cause the collapse of another part. So the challenge to keep attacking, to maintain the kind of tempo of operations across Iran, is enormous. And, well, I have to say, given everything that I've heard, both before the war and during the Ukraine war, about US equipment difficulties, I place far more weight on the various reports of shortages than I do in the assurances that the president himself and his officials continue to give us. And interestingly, I also noticed that even as the president assures us that the United States can keep going with this air op campaign for as long as it takes, basically, as I said, an unfortunate use of language, not used by the president himself, but something like that now being used by some of his officials. The US Defense Secretary, Pete Hegseth, is not ruling out boots on the ground. And we should be clear that that means American troops participating in some kind of ground operation against Iran. And the president himself talking in the same way. I think even Trump and Hegseth understand that for the American public, that would be going much too far. I think that they must worry that if something like that were ever attempted, then there would be not just opposition to the war, as reflected in the opinion polls in the United States, but actual protests against the war on a large scale. But the fact that they're talking about this at all is starting to suggest that they're becoming increasingly concerned. And there was a report yesterday that the president, Donald Trump himself, is conducting what we're told are confidential or secret or private or discreet conversations. How can they be any of these things when, as I said, they're being reported in the media with various leaders of Iraqi Kurdish militia groups to see whether they might be interested in participating in any military action against Iran? So I've provided a general overview of the state of the conflict, the military state of the conflict, as of this moment. To reiterate again, all Iran needs to do is to keep the war going. And all of these problems, the problems with energy costs, the problems with shortages of precision-guided weapons, all of these are going to inevitably start to increase within the next couple of days, within the next couple of weeks, within the next month or 2 months. I cannot say, obviously, exactly. But the Iranians need to be able to keep... What the Iranians need to do is to keep going. And, well, maybe some of the Iraqi Kurdish militia might want to try something very risky against Iran. Given that the United States recently abandoned the Kurdish militias in Syria, I wonder why the Kurdish militia in Iraq would agree to be used in this way. But then, of course, people do strange things, and no doubt there's money being offered and all of those kind of inducements. But anyway, bar something exceptional like that, bar some uprising within Iran itself, of which, to reiterate again, so far there is no sign, bar some significant defections by the Iranian military, the way this conflict is shaping up suggests a debacle. Debacle, perhaps too kind a word, a geopolitical disaster might turn out to be more accurate. Now, I am going to say that even more than the limits in terms of availability of precision-guided weapons and air defense weapons, I suspect that the single thing that is going to put pressure on the president is if he feels that there is real stress being caused in the global economy and in the US economy in particular. Oil and gas prices are rising. For the moment, the more visible pressure of this is in Europe. And if this continues for much longer, that pressure is going to intensify to a very significant degree. There are reports, I think these are wishful thinking, that China is trying to lean on Iran to allow exports of oil and gas to resume through the Straits of Hormuz. This report, I believe, has appeared in Bloomberg. The Chinese Foreign Minister, Wang Yi, has spoken to the Iranian Foreign Minister, appearing to give full support for Iran. And I read a ferocious editorial about the Israeli-American attack on Iran in Global Times, which is, as I've discussed many times, a semi-official newspaper published by the People's Daily, which is the official newspaper of the Communist Party of China. So I don't get the sense that the Chinese are putting much leverage, are putting much pressure on Iran at all at the moment. Just saying. But I read that some American financial institutions are assessing that if oil traffic through the Straits of Hormuz does not restart within 25 days, 3 weeks, just over 3 weeks in other words, then we could well be in a global energy crisis. And that will, of course, inevitably put enormous pressure on the president and his officials. There's also reports this morning in the Financial Times that bond prices, the government bond prices, are falling, that there is an avoidance within the financial markets of US treasuries, which is extraordinary. Nearly in every crisis of this kind, stretching back as far as I can remember, when there is a crisis like this, the international investment community rushes into US treasuries, which is seen as the safe haven. This doesn't seem to be the case anymore. And by contrast, bond yields are also rising. And there are some telltale reports that this might eventually start to seep its way through into the stock markets, which is something that the president is known to be especially sensitive to. And of course, if bond yields rise, then inevitably pressure within the United States for interest rates to rise as well is going to grow. And well, we all know what the President Donald Trump thinks about that. We're talking about Britain, by the way, which is the country where I live. There were some reports over the last few weeks about some supposed return to growth of the British economy this year. I never saw any sign of that myself, but apparently the British Finance Ministry, the Treasury, and Britain's Finance Minister, Chancellor Rachel Reeves, is now actually giving advice that she expects growth to be still lower last year than it was, that she's still lower this year than it was last year, which to my mind, what that suggests essentially is a recession situation. So I suspect that even more than the very real pressure caused by equipment shortages, the United States, the president himself, the administration, will increasingly feel the economic challenge, and that that might be the thing that causes them to change course. There is something else. I floated it already. A Chinese decision to stop exports of rare earths. it might already be taking place. The Chinese government is known to do this kind of thing without announcing it. Of course, the United States does have stockpiles of rare earths, but it's likely that because of supply disruptions during the trade war with China last year, these stockpiles have been reduced at least to some degree, just saying, in which case those stockpiles might not be sufficient to keep the United States and its military going for very long. It might, restrictions on rare earths, by the way, will not have, merely have an effect on military production, though that will be visible beyond a certain point as well. They will affect the civilian economy also, motor vehicle production, for example, production of passenger aircraft, production of advanced chips for the new AI computers, all of those sort of things. And of course, if the war continues and supply of rare earths from China are not coming through, then in order to keep the United States in the game against Iran, there might be pressure within the United States to start drawing on whatever stockpiles of rare earths there still are, which were previously allocated or assigned to the civilian economy. Now, if we ever find ourselves in that sort of situation, then we are going to be in what might be the biggest industrial and manufacturing crisis since the end of the Second World War. Anyway, these are all very dramatic outcomes. But of course, there is also hanging over everything the spectre of something else as well. The US Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, who I have previously found to be a very accomplished operator when giving briefings to the media. He knows how to handle the media very well, and he's a trained lawyer, so he knows how to use language very well also. Anyway, he had an uncharacteristically disastrous press conference. He struggled to come up with any coherent plan for the war going forward. He was challenged and didn't seem to be able to come up with a convincing explanation as to why the war was launched at all. There continues to be this drumbeat of claims from members of the administration, contradicted, by the way, by officials from within the Pentagon, that the United States and Israel were acted to preempt an Iranian attack, of which, to repeat again, there is no evidence at all, and which I don't believe anybody takes that claim seriously. Even the British media are not taking it seriously, just to say. But behind this appalling press conference, there continue to be reports that the United States was obliged to initiate this war at this particular time because of concerns that if it didn't, Israel would launch the war by itself, and that would put enormous pressures and create enormous problems for the United States. Now, what problems exactly? I mean, if Israel attacks Iran by itself, Obviously, the operation would fail if it was conducted strictly in conventional terms. The fact that Israel had to be bailed out by the United States during the June 2025 war, and what we have seen in the first 4 days of this war, show that Israel by itself cannot defeat Iran, a country of 90 million people with an enormous territory. Israel cannot defeat Iran by itself. This is why the Israelis have worked overtime to get the Americans on side. Well, I saw a report a couple of days ago which said that one of the reasons why the United States joined the June 2025 war was because they became worried that if they didn't, Israel might resort to nuclear weapons. And that was the eventuality that had to be avoided at almost any cost. Well, I don't know whether any calculations like that were really made in June of last year. I don't know whether any calculations like that exist now. I am very troubled and very disturbed that discussions of this kind are actually appearing in the media now. Reports of that kind are repeating in the media now. To be absolutely clear, however bad the economic situation might become, however bad for the president and his officials the situation might become also, any use of nuclear weapons would be the ultimate disaster. And that is the disaster that ought to be avoided at all costs. And if the United States has to acknowledge some kind of defeat with the president himself, his political position collapsing in consequence, well, that would still be, for him personally, by the way, a better outcome than a nuclear war against Iran, which would have consequences that I don't want to even think about, let alone discuss or imagine. Anyway, that is where we are at the moment. Now, there's a few further things to say. A lot of people have discussed a red mark that has appeared on the side of the president's neck. There's been much discussion about what this means. For the record, I've seen this sort of thing myself in the past. I am not a doctor. I am not going to give... Please don't put any weight on what I'm going to say. But when I've seen rashes like that appear, they have generally been stress symptoms. And if the president is under stress, it would not surprise me. And perhaps, given the situation, he ought to be. That's the first thing I'm going to say. The other thing that we haven't seen up to now is a set of demands from Iran. The US has had its demands. It's made its demands, its political demands of Iran, which, as I said, were massively excessive. What the United States for the moment appears to lack is a battle plan to win the war. Iran, by contrast, does appear to have a military plan, which is the plan it is executing for the moment, and I would say successfully. What Iran has not done so far is produce a set of its own political demands. Now, Alistair Crook, the former British diplomat who knows Iran very well far better than anyone in the West who I know. He says that the ultimate Iranian objective is to expel the United States from the Middle East. I floated this possibility in my program yesterday. I spoke about the Iranians perhaps considering a demand for the complete closure of all US bases across the Middle East. For the United States to agree to something like that would be a defeat of almost unimaginable dimensions. And it would be a crisis, by the way, for Israel as well. It would represent a dramatic shift in the balance of power. Any illusions that the United States were still the world's most powerful superpower would be shattered and shattered forever if the United States were obliged to agree to something like this. If that is the Iranian objective, then it is perhaps just as well that they have not yet announced it. Probably the Iranian plan is to wear down the United States as far as possible and only then start to work towards making demands like that. That would be, again, an intelligent and coherent Iranian strategy. But one has to also say this, there has continued to be extraordinary negligence on the Iranian side. Now, there was a long article yesterday in the Financial Times about how Israel and the United States managed successfully to assassinate Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. Now, there's been a lot of speculation, a lot of discussion that Khamenei himself set himself up for assassination, that he, in effect, embraced martyrdom. And there is no doubt about the fact that Khamenei has spoken about his willingness to embrace martyrdom. I've seen film of him making exactly that statement, and it appears to be recent film. And this very same article in the Financial Times confirms that Khamenei did have that thought in mind and has himself spoken in that way. However, that was not why he died on Saturday. It seems that the Israelis were keeping very close track on him. They'd hacked all the traffic cameras near his residence. They were able to see who was coming and who was going. Again, it seems it's extraordinary negligence on the part of Iran that they hadn't apparently considered that possibility, given Israel's known effectiveness in this kind of technological espionage. And it does seem as if Khamenei, when the attack took place, was not expecting it. He had his family present with him in his residence. Even his little granddaughter, whose death, I think, is an unspeakable tragedy. And it does seem as if all of the other top Iranian officials, the defense minister, the head of the IRGC, the chief of the general staff, all of these people did indeed attend this meeting in Khamenei's official residence, to which they were invited by Khamenei himself. Given what I have said about the certainty, about how it was obvious to me before the attack took place, several days before the attack took place, that an attack was coming, I still find it incredible that an experienced and clever man like Khamenei could have been trapped in that kind of way and could have allowed his military officials to be trapped with him. Anyway, regardless, the Iran does have its martyr. So does Shia Islam altogether. Photos have been published of the interior of Khamenei's residence before it was destroyed. They appear to confirm the many claims that he did indeed live a simple and ascetic life, which undoubtedly is going to have create an impression. Except the only thing I would say, and the further thing I would say, is that of course, and it's clear to me, to the surprise both of the United States and of Israel, Iran has survived. It's been able to continue to function, notwithstanding Khamenei's death. Contrary to many claims in the West, Iran has a complex political system. It did not revolve around Khamenei. He was in no sense Iran's dictator in the way that Saddam Hussein was, the dictator of Iraq. Just saying. But anyway, Iran has come through. For the moment, it appears to be defending itself competently and successfully. It seems other reports that the interim supreme leader has been killed were untrue. There are uncertainties about whether the former president Ahmadinejad was killed. There are contradictory reports about him. I don't even know, by the way, why, given that he's not played a significant role in Iranian politics for many years, why he was a target at all, but never mind. But anyway, for the moment at least, Iran has overcome whatever crisis there might have been following Khamenei's death, and it is fighting successfully. But it is still remarkable that he was assassinated in the way that he was at all. Now, let's now turn to the other big players. Lavrov and Wang Yi, the foreign ministers of China and Russia, have had a conversation and they're clearly working together and coordinating their positions. The Russians have reminded everybody that BRICS is not a military alliance, which is absolutely true, but they have already referred to the attack on Iran as an act of aggression. The Gulf Arab states clearly see the Russians as major players. I spoke yesterday about how all of them, not so far Kuwait, but Qatar, the UAE, and maybe Kuwait as well, did indeed contact Putin over the previous hours, over the previous day. Later, Putin had a call with MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and the Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia as well, Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler. MBS, of course, there are reports that even as he was publicly opposing an attack on Iran, he was quietly in private urging Donald Trump to carry it out. Those are the reports. They have not been contradicted. He spoke a very, very different tale to Vladimir Putin over the course of his call with Putin. He spoke also about the need for an urgent end to hostilities. One can understand why, because for Saudi Arabia, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz is a crisis. And of course, if the Iranians come after the desalination plants in Saudi Arabia, it is going to be much worse than that. But anyway, all of that is obviously a matter of massive concern for MBS. And he seems to be trying to talk to Putin to see whether Putin can somehow find a way through. Now, in theory, the Russians are well positioned to act as mediators in this conflict. They have excellent relations with Iran, and they have been developing economic relations with Iran as well. I read a long article just yesterday in the Iranian media about how economic relations between Iran and Russia have been starting to develop. And of course, Russia can become, in time, Iran's a major supplier of military equipment, as well as China. Russia could, in effect, become Iran's long-term security guarantor, as China also could. But there's been, obviously, a total collapse of trust on the Iranian side. And I get the sense that on the Russian side, there isn't a huge amount of trust towards the Americans either. And that's putting it mildly. Reports that I have seen circulating that there are calls inside Russia to end completely the dialogue with the United States over Ukraine, I believe are true. I say that because Peskov, Putin's spokesman, continued to insist yesterday that maintaining the dialogue with the Americans was in Russia's interests, which is, in a kind of a way, an admission that there are some voices within the Russian elite that are now demanding that those talks with the Americans should be discontinued entirely. So this debate in Moscow continues, and it's been given renewed force. Though I think, knowing the way the Russians conduct their diplomacy, and the Chinese as well, they will not actually, in the end, cut off dialogue with the Americans. They will do what they can, within reason, to keep Iran fighting. They will use that to gain more leverage over the Americans. And perhaps, as they sense that that leverage is increasing, that is when they're going to step in and tell the Americans and perhaps the Iranians that the time has come to stop. I am not saying that that strategy is going to succeed. Iran, for example, has shown that it is absolutely its own agent in these matters. But I suspect that that is what the Russians and the Chinese, for the moment, are proposing to do. In the meantime, the Russians are, of course, perfectly aware that this equipment crisis that the Americans are now facing in the Middle East plays overwhelmingly to their advantage on the battlefields of Ukraine. And there are lots of reports that there is going to be another big Russian combined drone and missile strike against Ukraine within the next 48 hours. Of course, with all the air defense missile interceptors now being transferred to the Middle East, and with Donald Trump calling Zelensky P.T. Barnum, what ability will Ukraine before long have to shoot down these missiles and drones? By the way, on that topic, as I understand it, this laser system, that this experimental laser that the Americans have deployed in northern Israel, has some effectiveness against drones, but no significant effectiveness against missiles. It is primarily an anti-drone weapon. Just saying. That's what I've heard. Anyway, I'm not going to get into a discussion of this. If anybody knows otherwise, they are welcome to tell me about it. But anyway, that is the military. That is something that the Russians are aware of. They've made further big inroads in Ukraine over the last few days. But even the Ukrainians are now acknowledging that after the mud season, the period of the Rasputitsa, ends at the end of March and the beginning of April, the big Russian summer offensive of 2026 in Ukraine will begin. And Ukraine, short of men on the front lines, short of equipment already, unable to get more equipment from the United States, which is far and away the most important equipment provider, because the Americans aren't able to sell equipment to the Europeans anymore, because what equipment they do produce is going to the Middle East. The Americans will not be in a position to help them through the offensive that is coming in the summer. So far, there is no word of further negotiations between Russia, Ukraine, and the United States. The venue of the next tripartite negotiations was supposed to be Abu Dhabi. I don't think anybody expects a further meeting in Abu Dhabi very soon, for fairly obvious reasons. There is no proposal or idea of a meeting anywhere else. And one wonders whether Witkoff and Kushner, given the crisis in the Middle East, would be interested in attending such a meeting. Starting from April, the war in Ukraine is going to intensify massively, and the Ukrainians are going to face, for the first time since 2022, the might of the Russian military, mostly by themselves. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish this program today. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop. Please don't forget also to check out our Substack site. Links for all of these under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.